Accession number 10609, rule 3.
Squirrel, room 3.
I remember at Grangemouth one day, one evening, some of my airwomen complained that they had been frightened by, I don't know who, men, when they'd come in off their passes late at night. And this particular house in Shara Grange had been requisitioned from some Scottish person, and it was down, the entrance was down a short steep hill, and I suppose I said something about this in the mess, and so the young officers immediately said, oh, we'll deal with it for you, and we rode round the perimeter of the air base at Grangemouth, the airfield, and we got to the top of the hill going down to Inshara Grange, and to my horror, without any sort of pause, no sort of consultation, two of them suddenly dashed down the hill because we could see a figure standing in the middle of the road. And luckily, at the last minute, just as they got there, intent on bowling this figure over, the figure leapt in two parts. In other words, it was an airman and an airwoman kissing each other goodnight. And the two young pilots collided and went into the ditch. So there were the four of them in the ditch, the two young pilots, the airman saying goodbye, goodnight to his airwoman, and myself very concerned at the top of the hill. That was the sort of, you know,
were the Battle of Britain pilots lionised by the public, would you say?
Oh, yes. Oh, very much so. I think we had sort of two types. There were the ones who'd come in rather later, and there were, of course, the ones who, like ourselves, were very proud of their auxiliary status and had been pilots before the war. And I think you would say they were, what's the word I want, arrogant, a bit. I often thought, I mean, I may be wrong, but I've often thought it must have been jolly difficult for the NCOs and the air crews to sort of feel at home with those sort of pilots. You know, because they were all on a dispersal point together. And I didn't at the time. It's difficult to know what one sort of thought because one wasn't so, you know, one hadn't much experience of life. But I think, yes, quite definitely arrogance. They had a sort of conversation of their own, you know, it was difficult to understand. And but my goodness, they did a marvellous job.
When you say they had a conversation of their own, you
well, they had a language of their
jargon.
Own. Yes, jargon, yes. And subjects, you know, after all, if you know what you're talking about, you can sort of use half sentences, and other people were cut out. But I think, I mean, if you know what I mean, we were women, there were very few of us, very few WEF officers there, and the pilots used to come and we weren't allowed into the main mess there, into the male mess. We had our own section of it in Grangemouth, but the young pilots very often used to come through and talk to us. I suppose they had sisters and that sort of thing at home. And some of them were very frightened. I mean, they told us. I remember saying to one, and he was killed very shortly afterwards, he'd been in an air scrap and he thought he was a goner. And I said to him, how did you feel? And he looked at me and said, well, I haven't prayed since I was a child, but he said, I prayed as I've never prayed before. And I remember that because I thought to myself, well, you know, there must be something in religion after all when you really are sort of up against it.
Could I ask you about what the attitude was towards the work that women did in the services during the war?
Well, at Grangemouth, we had a CO who was definitely anti-WAF, the first CO when I went. I opened up the station and he didn't want us. And he was a grumpy little sod. And he made life very difficult. You know, it isn't easy. I mean, I had no experience of opening a ghastly sort of war situation. There I was, pushed off to do a job I hadn't much clue about, doing my best, and he did absolutely nothing to help.
What was the source of his anti-WAF feeling, do you think?
Well, he just didn't want us there, and he made it plain. I mean, keeping us out of the mess, it's the only mess I've ever kept out of. One would never have thought of going and sitting near him, you know, because we were in there, we dined in the same place, we had to, the staff. He was rather, I felt, inclined to pitch in, you know, if the women cooks went to his liking, he was inclined to sort of find fault. He had an extremely nice adjutant, and that helped very much indeed, a very diplomatic and older man, which helped a lot, because I just simply went to the adjutant and didn't go to the CO. Mind you, I think the CO had some things to complain about. We had one very difficult airwoman who had obviously been on the streets, and stuff was going missing and all that sort of thing. And my mother was very ill with, afterwards it turned out to be cancer, and I took a long weekend, and this young airwoman was brought in trouble again. The CO marched her in, and I put her on charge in the guardroom, and then went off on my weekend. And in the middle of the weekend, or perhaps it was a week, I can't remember, but in the middle of my time away, I think it was a week, there was a hectic call from the adjutant to say this woman had been confined to barracks, and you know, AMOs didn't allow this just to be left like that. And I said to him miserably, I put her there to keep her out of trouble while I'm away. And he said, come back immediately. And I said, I can't, I'm taking my mother to a specialist. So he saw to it for me. I think they kept it out from, you know, from the knowledge of the CO, but I'm not sure.
Was he unusual or typical in his anti-WAF attitude?
No, I think there were a number of them resented the airmen. Perhaps that's why we liked Stuffy so much, because obviously he was concerned when his... I mean, it had to be run very efficiently at Bentley Priory, and he was obviously concerned. We were all from a social class when, you know, perhaps we hadn't been under much discipline. And he recognised that, you know, we'd changed our spots and were keen to do our very best, and he appreciated, and somehow one sort of felt that he was appreciative. But some of these are, I mean, I think it wasn't only to us. I can clearly remember a young pilot telling me that some of the COs, I don't know, they didn't think they're COs, but you know, perhaps they'd landed on their stations or something, and they were very unsympathetic, and you know, they hadn't naturally earned the Battle of Britain. You didn't conform to regulations, you just simply forgot them and hoped to survive. And if you have someone who sticks to the rules and regulations, I mean, I'd hate to be in the RAF now. Can I think of all the naughty things we did?
Such as?
And the lack of... I'm not going to tell you. The lack of concern for... I mean, you know, they used to send these stupid things, RTOs, I think they were called, round, and you were supposed to read them. And
you mean petty regulations?
Yeah.
Coming back to the Battle of Britain at Fighter Command Headquarters, Were you able to get any kind of picture of the disparity in military force between the Germans and the RAF during that period?
Yes, we used to see the plots. I think we saw it in our mind's eye, even though it was only plots. We'd see these plots going round and round over the, where we knew the fields were in France, and they'd be the bombers, and they'd be going round and round and stacking themselves up, and the radar would give us an idea of how many were coming over. The biggest one I remember was put at 1,000 plus, and then as they started off, or at least as they got into their stack, you see from different airfields the fighters getting up. They of course went straight up into a sort of cloud, they didn't have to stack round or anything, and then they would rise higher and higher because they were there to defend the bombers. And then they'd head, we didn't know where they were going to go. Of course, as I think I've told you, there appeared to be different stages of the battle, when first of all they bombed the shipping, and then I think they bombed largely the airports and the radar stations. And then of course it was the cities of Britain. So we didn't know where they were heading for, except of course we knew the ones coming from Scandinavia were going for the Midlands and Scotland. But it was frightening. There was tremendous tension in the ops room. And then of course we only saw the plots, but the girls working in the filter room actually heard the sectors talking to the aircraft, and the sector commander chose the sector that was to intercept. I think was directed from Bentley Priory, but I think the sector commander chose which of his aircraft would be scrambled, and there seemed to be a policy of sending a few aircraft up they didn't send the whole lot up. I think afterwards they used to send great wings of aircraft up, but Stuffy seemed to just sort of try and conserve his forces and send a few up at a time, and that was the impression one got. And there were dogfights going on all over the place trying to break these things up, and it must have been very frightening for their bombers, because as far as I can remember there used to be sort of two waves of fighter, one lot used to come over with them, and then there used to be another sort of fresh lot arriving. But then I think the Germans must have run short of pilots too, because I don't remember, you know, two lots coming over once they'd really got going. I think we took a toll on them too. They must have, you know, been licking their wounds as well as us.
Would you say that the fighter command headquarters ran efficiently during the Battle of Britain?
Yes. I think it was a marvellous conception. Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, if we hadn't had that radar and the Observer Corps, I mean, great admiration for the Observer Corps. I mean, I don't know. No, I don't think they had any equipment, as far as I know. And after all, in all that bad weather in July, it mustn't have been easy with all those clouds and everything. Frankly, I've never thought about it before, but I really don't know how they managed when there were clouds about. You must have just guessed, I should think, at the sound of the... One could tell very often, you know, the sound of the engines. They deliberately got the... When they were double engine, they used to deliberately get them out of...
Synchronisation.
Yes.